Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I am here with Michael Walker, my co-host. How are you doing, Walker?
Hello.
I am your other co-host, Mark Pickney, and I gotta say, checking over my notes, I am super excited to talk to you this week about games.
All the games?
All the games. Short games, long games, bow-legged games, all of... Oh, wait, sorry. The Gibbons informing me that there's been some sort of mistake and that my preparation is all off base.
Uh-oh. Is your key stuck again?
Yeah, I'd like to buy a vowel.
Uh-oh.
So we're going to talk about the game we reviewed last year, the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, The Eurus. We're going to talk about the games we played last week, the news, and why it doesn't matter. And then our topic this week. Our topic this week is adventure games.
Adventure!
If only. So, Walker, what did we review last year?
Last year, we reviewed a game called El Grande?
The Big.
The Biggin. So has the Big reprint come out for it yet? It's been announced, but
no.
Is it actually? It has, okay.
It's not in wide distribution yet. If there may be some European markets that already have it, but I haven't seen it hit stateside, and if it is, it's not really available much in a widespread way.
So the Big Daddy of Area Control, this is what it's all about.
I see what you did there.
El Grande.
Yeah, played it since we reviewed it. Perennial classic. Just it's one of those things where, honestly, it's as good as everyone says. I mean... don't think there's much else to say about Grande.
Yeah, it always hits, but comes back to the table.
Yeah.
Good at different player counts, regardless of what other people say.
Well.
No, I didn't say all player
counts. Okay.
I said many player counts.
As
in five or four.
That's many? Okay.
It's more than one.
Fair enough. Point taken. Yes, El Grande, frequently imitated, rarely repeated. One of the progenitors of both the card-driven format and a very majority more broadly. El Grande. By Wolfgang Kramer and Richard Ulrich, originally published in 1999, soon to be reprinted.
And now on to the games we played this week. Mark, what did you play this week?
I played Age of Innovation again. I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was discussing how, despite the fact that he's big into board games, there are a couple of the sort of perennial classics of the genre that he is not very familiar with. One of the ones he mentioned was Agricola. And I'm like, oh, I'd happily play Agricola any time. And the other, he said, well, what's that one that I frequently see in stores, Terra Mystica? He's like, yeah, I'm very curious about that. I was like, well, son, I've got Age of Innovation in my trunk. You want to play Age of Innovation? So we played Age of Innovation, and it did make me appreciate more the details about how it differs from Terra Mystica.
Isn't that how a drug deal goes down? It's like, I've always wanted to try cocaine. Well, my friend, come over to my trunk.
Is that how it works?
I'm not sure. It sounds like a drug deal.
I just
have a taste of this.
I'm not
this
familiar.
Innovation here.
I don't think I've ever consumed illegal substances, all but right. I don't think that's typically how it goes.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
That raises several questions that I will not ask.
Seems sus.
So I'm really appreciating the customizability of various factions. Like, for example, I play the Illusionists, and the Illusionist faction ability is that every time they do a power action, they get a discount and they get points. But by default, they don't have any power generation. And indeed, it happened to be paired with a terrain faction that doesn't have a particularly advantageous starting power distribution. But one of the palaces that was available to be drafted generated a lot of power. And so I do the thing that is very, very dangerous, but I think in this case it paid off. I rushed to get the palace very early. I believe it might have even been in round two, or certainly no later than round three. And consequently, I was generating lots and lots and lots of power. I was able to ping the ability very often. Of course, this too is a variant dependent on the number of players, right? Because the number of power actions that's available to you in Age of Innovation are fixed regardless of whether you're playing a solo game or all the way up to five players. And so I don't know if this is going to lead to the kind of structural imbalances that the hardcore players of Terra Mystica complain about. I think with good reason. If you're going to be playing a Euro game, you know, 50 to 100 times like some people do, if there are serious factional imbalances, that's going to be a problem, and it might rankle people.
Especially if you're doing it competitively, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. You know, the people who track wins and losses, who care about such things, it can absolutely stick in some people's craw. That having been said, playing like a monkey, that's the only way I know how to play, and that is not offensive to Gibbons. Gibbons, remember, are apes.
Gotcha.
But playing like a monkey, it doesn't really bother me. It rather allowed me to sort of navigate the available things to draft and customize my faction as it came out. Now, did it address my fundamental concerns about Age of Innovation that we expressed when we played it the first time? Not at all. It's enjoyable, but it's way over long, and at the end of the day, I can't help but feel like I've spent a whole lot of time not doing very much. It's like, oh, I've built some workshops and some maybe got my palace out, and 3 points here and 5 points at, all right. And that's fine. If it were half the length, I think it might be one of my favorite games, honestly. But as it is, you know, for 3 hours of just constantly scraping out this action to do this action to do this other action just so I can get the two tools necessary so I can put out that trading post. It's well, it's extremely well designed, but it's one of those designs that I respect more than enjoy. I was happy to show it to somebody else because they were very, very curious about the system. And I do like various elements of the core system that is iterated through Terra Mystica all the way now to Age of Innovation. But ultimately, I think this is one of those systems that I think I've seen done a number of times, and I don't think it's ever really going to please me.
How do you think they walked away from it?
Well, what was strange was they commented that they enjoyed it. And they felt that their curiosity had been satisfied, and they would be eager to play again. They commented that it was the most complicated game they'd ever played, which I found surprising, given that their favorite game is Mage Knight. And I personally, that just led me to reflect on the fact that different people parse complexity in different ways. To my mind, Mage Knight is vastly more complicated. Well, not vastly, but significantly more complicated than Age of Innovation. Age of Innovation, at the end of the day, is relatively clean in terms of the stuff. There's lots of options to be done about things, but the sheer number of interactions in Mage Knight and the sheer number of special abilities and the way different sites work and the way different movement options work to get to those sites and how sometimes when you assault, you go next to it. Oh, is it day or is it night? Oh, is this one of the places where I can bring in allies? Oh, can I not activate the ally in this context? Oh, sure. Etc.
I feel it's a lot of corner cases in Mage Knight, whereas in a game like Age of Innovation, everything is front-loaded. Everything you need to interact with almost all the time.
I disagree, because I think it's quite the opposite. In Mage Knight, you necessarily have to be interacting with those edge cases. Every time something shows up on the map, you need to account for what that map thing is going to do. Whereas with Age of Innovation, fundamentally, the core thing that you're doing, again, is you're just building these buildings. That's what you're doing. And building a workshop, building a trading post, building any of the buildings is very straightforward. Understand how shovels work, pay some number of tools and money, there you go, you build a building.
It's true, but what ramifications or what is that going to lead to, or why are you doing those things, or how is that going to help you in the future?
Yeah, but all of those questions apply to the Mage Knight situation equally, I think.
Maybe.
All right. Well, anyway, that was Age of Innovation. Now, Walker, do you think this leads naturally to a segue of any kind?
No.
Okay. Well, then pick random game we played last week.
We played Mage Knight.
Okay.
This is designed by Vlado Cevadel and put out by WizKids. And it is a favorite of ours. We play it. I shouldn't say we play it often. But it has stayed in our collections for quite a while. It has a lot of expansions, and one of the big questions is when you bring it out to the table, what type of Mage Knight are we going to play? Is it going to be competitive? Is it going to be a type of cooperative? Are we going to be fighting a boss? How many castles are we going to take over? How long do we want to play? What kind of map do we want to play at? So sometimes that can be a barrier to get it to the table, but usually, a lot of times when I play, I just start putting out map tiles and just go from there. Because we're really, when you think about
you're a freewheeling anarchist, Walker.
Because usually when you think about it, that's usually what you're just going to end up doing anyway. You're going to be exploring all the green tiles and then getting to the brown tiles and then defeating the cities. Why mess around? Just get to it.
Well, but that's the you've described the conquest scenario.
Well, yeah.
Well, then what?
So, I suppose.
Which is kind of, I think the perception is, rightly, that it is the sort of default scenario. So I don't think you've suggested something half so revolutionary as you implied. And that is indeed what we played. We played the co-op conquest. I think the biggest barrier to getting Mage Knight back to the table is, number one, it's so similar to every other game, so we feel like we play it all the time.
It's true.
And number two, we it's long. And we played it this time with three. Three is the most I'm willing to play it with. I've played it before with four, never again. And I think that three is pushing it. I'd much rather play it solo or with just two people.
No, and even with just sort of how the map works out, if you have four, usually there's one person that is getting left out, or it's back and forth, and
yes,
two people are slightly left out. With three, you have like one going up each side, one down the middle, and you can sort of divvy up the bennies, I guess.
Right, and that's when playing co-op, despite the fact that we had a relatively good division near the early and late bits, there were occasions where we got in each other's way, which is awkward, because getting from point A to point B in Mage Knight can be difficult. It is one of the many challenges you have to overcome. But it's well implemented in terms of the card. The card management is brilliant. The hand management, the card management, the way deck building is implemented. I think it was one of the very first games that looked at deck building and said, this is what you can do with deck building. And it just blew open the paradigm in a significant way and in a very helpful way. And getting in people's way is not fun. The alternative is to play competitively, and then you can either play with the, I think, garbage PvP rules, or you can play where you're just blocking each other, and neither one of them is very satisfying. So co-op is usually the way to go. The dummy player is very, very easy to manage. It's just a clock. There's also an app that runs it just fine. And so that's indeed how we played. We played the co-op full conquest scenario. It took us about 4 hours all told. With two players, I think it would have taken 2.5 to 3. I mean, really, just adding more players just makes the game longer. And Mage Knight has one of the paradigmatic issues I have with adventure games, which is sooner or later they boil down to a gut check. You have to make some sort of vaguely holistic analysis of whether or not you're able to do the thing. And fortunately, one way in which Mage Knight makes it slightly better is the thing that you're trying to do only shows up relatively late in the game anyway, and the thing you're trying to do in Conquest is to sack cities. Sacking cities is hard. There's a large stack of very scary things that's willing to bite your head off when you're going to do that, and the game can be overlong, on even longer than the, 2 to 4 hours, if you're overly cautious and you don't know whether you're ready to go sack a city yet. Not that I can blame anybody. It's a tough decision to make. You look at those numbers, I can't generate 26 attack in a single hand of cards. Like, well, sometimes you can, and you don't know it. Anyway, we've talked a lot about Mage Knight. It doesn't hit the table often, as you say, but it's frequently in our thoughts. And
yes,
many games get compared to it unfavorably for those other games. I think it is a bona fide classic. And here's one thing that I will point out. So Age of Innovation is a relatively contemporary design, and in many ways has lots of contemporary design aesthetics and contemporary approaches to components. Mage Knight, on the other hand, which was released over 10 years ago, the thing is that we've got this sort of natural assumption about a correlation between a game's weight to its setup time, and some games recently have very much borne that out. Voidfall comes to mind. But then there's Mage Knight. Especially after coming on the heels of Age of Innovation, it's like, okay, gotta set this thing up. It's like, oh, wait, we're done. There's hardly any setup to do. Shuffle that deck, make a supply, put out some tiles. Oh, all right. It's not trivial, but given the weight of the game and given the weight of other games, a lot of medium to heavy Euros that have 12 different piles of chits and tokens that need to be shuffled, it's comparatively nothing.
It's true. And had we played like a second time, like immediately sooner, and we'd, be right up to date with how to play, it would take even faster.
Yes, there were some, we didn't even do any sort of refresher at the beginning. In hindsight, that was possibly a mistake. There were some issues, some core issues that some players had forgotten, like how often can I play a card sideways? How many dice can I take from the source? Stuff like that. Stuff that I mean, no disrespect or an insult, that I had assumed everyone kind of remembered, but that some people didn't. And that's fine. We go through a lot of games, and it is what it is, and some people remember details, and some people don't. And It varies by game. Anyway, so probably next time a 15-minute refresher would be salutary. And so I'll take the blame for that. So that was Mage Knight, the board game. Always a joy to get back to. As I commented on a recent episode of Bloat, I'm going to try to make more of an effort to make sure that a month doesn't go by without revisiting some of the titles from the canon. A month without the canon is a mistake.
Agreed.
Got to play another game of Gnar. This is by Thomas Dupont and Bombix. A marvelous filler. 20 to 30 minutes. Race to points. And I'm always reminded when playing Gnar how subtle the timing can be. Because a less well-designed game, I think, would be build up your tableau, build up your tableau, build up your tableau, explosion of points, game end. And this isn't even a question of duration. Gnar actually is more like knowing when to build up your tableau and knowing when to go for the points. Because sometimes you're going to have a couple of major explosions of points. Sometimes you just build up that tableau and pumping the tableau is your explosion of points on occasion. And then if you can then parlay that into yet more points, that's very key to success. But knowing the ebb and flow, reacting to what's available, knowing when to pump the cards, knowing when to buy other cards, it really is marvelous given its weight, given its duration. Gnar gets a lot of things really right. I was very, very glad to come back to it, and everyone else was pleased to see it again back too. Gnar.
Yeah, easy to teach. Amazing game. Did a stream again this week, every Saturday, 12:30. We're streaming. This week we did The Fox Experiment. This is Elizabeth Hargraves and Jeff Fraser's newest game. It is put out by Pandasaurus Games. It's based off the Russian fox experiments they did because they bred foxes for fur and they were a bit vicious. They wanted to make them friendlier, so they started to do selective breeding.
Well, the hypothesis was, the scientists doing the experiment, I did a little bit of reading on it, it's very interesting. The hypothesis was that if you bred for behavioral traits, morphological and physiological changes would necessarily follow. And it turns out that hypothesis was largely correct. You get droopy ears, you get mottled fur, you get differently shaped skulls, even though they weren't breeding for those characteristics, they were just breeding for friendliness and eagerness to interact with humans.
And that's what you're doing in the game. I think the hook of the game, or the interesting part of the game, is the initial draft, because you need to draft a male and a female and
a vixen walker.
Sorry.
Called a vixen.
I'm sorry. And sort of turn order and or an ability for that turn. And you get to choose them in any order. So it's one of those games where, well, almost everyone's picked a female. I can leave that one there because it's going to stay. Right. So I'm going to pick something else instead. So the male has a certain number of dice and so does the female. And then you get your special dice that you have and you roll them and you're matching these symbols. Some of the dice have, you know, 1.5 symbols or just a half. And so you're lining up all these dice and they all correspond to those traits that you were talking about. Spots on the face, floppy ears, fur, an appealing bark. And then when you line up all your dice, you take your card and it's actually a dry erase marker and you start ticking off all of these results that you got and you present your fox for that round. It's like, okay, well, I have a friendliness factor of X because I've ticked off that many boxes. And then they go up and they're part of the next draft that you can make. They're going to be the next mother or father. And depending on how many ticks they got, they're going to get their own dice, and they're also going to get these trait tokens. And then you use these trait tokens to give yourself more abilities, which are going to give you more dice, which let you also breed more than just one fox a turn, gives you more objectives, all sorts of different things you get to unlock on your board. I think in all, it is a great game because everyone's doing stuff at the same time. It flows very well. It moves very quickly, and you get to roll a lot of dice. Rolling dice is fun.
It is.
You get to roll the dice. You get to match your symbols. Lots of good things happening. Special a bit like objectives on the left-hand side of the board to sort of, you know, match if, you know, getting columns. They change up every game, so it could be almost anything from having certain number of tokens on your board to all sorts of different things. There's a bunch of special cards you can get that give you abilities, or you save them for points at the end.
How many rounds of drafting is there?
6.
Great.
I believe there's 6.
Okay.
And near the end, it gets a little long.
Oh.
I mean, no, I shouldn't say that. I just mean that because it's happening at the same time, but just like the last few rounds, because some players have 3 foxes they can breed. So what they do is they roll the dice, they fill out their fox, and then they roll the dice again and fill out another one, and then roll the dice. And
so, I see.
So that might take a little while, but all in all, it's pretty awesome. I'm looking forward to trying it again. The Fox Experiment.
It's been a good run, Walker. We've been doing this for almost 10 years.
Agreed.
I'm afraid you're going to have to find a new co-host because I'm about to get canceled hardcore.
Uh-oh.
I'm afraid. Look, I was sincerely tempted to try to mince my words or...
I could have sworn that it was going to be me that did this.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I really strongly dislike Android Netrunner. I'm sorry. This is it. We're done. Uh-oh. I can hear the angry replies being penned as we speak.
Why is my computer blowing up?
Okay. So I played Android Netrunner all of twice. Once shortly after it came out when I strongly disliked it. And once again this week when I really strongly disliked it.
Oh, he talked you into it. Did you? He likes it so much and you agree.
No, this is not. This is not. Okay, there are a number of locals that are big, big fans of Android Netrunner. A lot of people love Android Netrunner. This isn't even the local that you're probably thinking of. This is somebody else. And when he suggests, oh, like, yeah, we could play one of these Android Netrunner, it's like, please show me Android Netrunner again. So there was one thing that I just completely forgotten about the design, and that is, and this is, I'll start with it because it's the least salient to my lack of enjoyment of it. It's obnoxious use of keywords. You don't get a hand of cards, Walker. You can have a headquarters or R&D or your archives or stuff like that. Like, look, there's only one publisher that I'm willing to let get away with stuff like that, and that is Devious Weasel Games. All right? I'm not a fan of it when Devious Weasel does it, but I'm willing to give them a pass. Moving on. Fundamentally, Android Netrunner is all about action efficiency. It is just about action. It's an action to take a dollar. It's an action to take a card. It's an action to play a card. It's an action to play the card that gives you lots of dollars, but you can get in those dollars that saves you actions. You can just blunt force almost anything with actions if you want to. And so what it comes down to is, do you have the card that will save you the actions when you need it? Now, some of this certainly comes down to deck construction, but I was also reminded why I really don't like deck construction games of this ilk much anymore. Because if you're building a 45-card deck, and you're not going to be going through all of it in a given game in all likelihood, what are you doing with yourself? Like, seriously, like, what's going on here? Like, what you're basically doing is playing with some sort of weird probabilistic scattershot opportunity. It's like, well, am I going to get mana screwed or not? Well, I don't know. Here's the right formula. This is the right ratio to follow. But that helps you avoid getting mana screwed more often, but it doesn't prevent the problem entirely. Honestly, one of the reasons why I completely got ruined for deck construction games of this ilk are games like Blue Moon and Ordis Regni. You're going to go through your entire deck in all likelihood in those games. You're going to be able to hold on to the cards and set the combos that you want, rather than be in a position, as I was several times in Android Netrunner, like, I'm out of money. I don't have any of the cards that get me money. Oh, except for this one. It costs money to do. Okay, I have three actions. I guess I'm spending three actions to get three money. That's my turn. Now, I'm not saying that I played properly, and I'm not saying that I had a good, well-constructed deck, but there I was hating it. I mean, that's just where I was. Now, I'm sure there are, if I got deep into the weeds, if I internalize all those silly keywords, if I craft the deck that works for me, if everything starts firing on all cylinders, I'm still at the mercy of what comes out when.
Oh, wait, here's one.
Oh, yeah?
I'm reading the replies already.
Yeah, yeah?
Get good.
Yeah, yeah. L2P?
Nub.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. I was waiting for that. Look, if you like your Android Netrunner, I completely respect the passion of the fan base, and I completely respect the fact that there are people sufficiently devoted to the system that it's been resurrected several times, or rezzed, if you will. That's another keyword in Android Netrunner, by the way.
How clever.
I didn't enjoy any aspect of it, and it did not inspire me to go and craft a better deck to spec. I have no interest in that class of game anymore. And even in the context of that class of game, I did not enjoy the way Netrunner focuses everything into just a relentless optimization of actions. That's what it is. That's what it boils down to. In my experience, this has been my run at So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you very much. I anticipate being torn to pieces by an angry mob. That would be meat damage, by the way, in the context of...
Keyword meat.
That is Android Netrunner, designed by Richard Garfield and Lucas Litzinger, originally resurrected by Fantasy Flight Games in 2012, later resurrected by other fine people. That is Android Netrunner. It is what it is.
More on Android later. Mark, does it have bees?
Android Netrunner?
Yes.
I'm sure there is some kind of clever ice or icebreaker involving bees.
Well, Apery has bees.
Yes,
this
it does.
This is designed by Connie Vogman. And put out by Stonemaier Games. This is the Stonemaier's latest output, where you get to play Space Bees. So you have your mat, you have your workers, you're putting out your little workers that are sort of like square sort of D4s, as you were, and they're...
They're D6s, but two of the faces are occupied by a B-head and a B-butt.
It's true.
So and you there are four values to display on your B-worker.
And that's sort of the strength of their action when they go out. And when there are four, they get to do a super-duper action. Whew. And so you're upgrading your board by putting out these tiles, farm tiles, and
instant... Hex tiles, of course.
Yes, of course.
Yes.
Well, the honeycomb tiles, yes.
Precisely.
And instant tiles and endgame tiles, all sorts of things.
Special power tiles.
Yeah, lots of cool stuff. And then there's the giant bee, the queen bee.
Even. Oh, it's such a nice figure.
It's so plumpy.
It's a giant plump bee with rocket boosters.
It's great. And you move it around this grid, and it sort of populates planets with resources, and you can get resources. Lots of things going on. You get to do the bee dance. Bee dance is fun.
It's true. You get to choreograph bee dances. Get some Bob Fosse on it, your jazz hands and everything.
And I really think I enjoyed playing Apiary.
Okay.
And I think I want to go back. I think there's lots to do in that game. There's lots of different ways you can purchase tiles. There's tons of different factions you can play or leader abilities or however you want to put it. And there's lots to do, lots of different ways to play that game.
So I have two primary comments about Apiary. One of them is, I think it really highlights one of the things that I commented on when talking about Ceres. If you're making a game, especially if you're going to orient it towards sci-fi and space, you can make it about anything. And Apiary is like, I'm going to make this about far future sapient bees. And to that I say, well done. Like, go for it, right? There's no reason not to go for it. And I really appreciate it. The pictures from Quan Chi Moria of little space bees with their little space helmets, adorable. The queen bee miniature, no notes. The hexagonal arrangement of your little bee ships, marvelous. Now, I think they could have been a little bit more creative in terms of the names of the different factions, but whatever. That's just quibbling. The second thing that I will observe is that most of Apiary I found forgettable and pedestrian. I did like the base building aspect because there was both a question of what kind of tile you want. There are endgame scoring, there are instant ones, there are farms, and then there are special powers that are shockingly interesting, frankly, in terms of action efficiency. And there's also a spatial element in that. To a limited extent, where you put them on your base matters, and the order in which you purchase them and how you arrange them. And that part I thought was the most enjoyable, which is unusual because normally that part of a game like this, which is less interactive and more spatial, is usually not my kind of jam. But it's just the rest of the worker placement in Apiary I thought was more or less just fine. One thing about the worker placement that was a little bit more interesting was, as opposed to most worker placement games where you want to go where on, you know, the available space for the purposes of blocking, here you want to go to the hot spaces because you want to get dislodged. Being dislodged by a worker is good, and it accelerates the growth of your bees. In rare circumstances, you might want to wait, but generally speaking, you want a high turnover of bees. And that was kind of cool. But the rest of it, honestly, like the variable strength of the workers didn't really do much. Basically, most of the time it was either the worker is a 4 and something amazing happens or doesn't really matter all that much. I mean, honestly, the difference between a 1 and a 3, mostly it's just how close are you to getting to the 4. So I didn't feel like that was really exploited to its greatest potential. I found a lot of the scoring elements to be very situational in a borderline frustrating way. Like, you get a lot of points from these cards called seeds. Getting a seed into play is a satisfyingly involved affair, but a lot of them are just really, really limiting, and so you draw them near the end of the game, and you might be like, if this is your only seed, score 7 points. I'm like, I've already
The Ticket to Ride deck.
Yeah, more or less. Only in the reverse, because in Ticket to Ride, you might just draw a bunch of cards you've already scored. The seeds mostly are draw a whole bunch of things like, okay, I get this if I don't add any annexes I've already added too. I can score this if it's my only seed I've already scored a seed. Okay.
Well, mine went the other way. It's like, you know, get this many points if you've collected these tokens. It's like, oh, well, I collected those tokens, so I'm
sure,
good.
Sure. It's just that problem I find less noxious, less problematic than the other problem.
So I really enjoy dice worker placement games. If you've played Praetor, you might like this as well, because once the bees mature to 4, they have to retire, and you do stuff. That's a whole mechanism.
They go to the honeycomb upstate. Yeah.
And it also has an interesting thing about resource generation. You have to place it in certain spots on your home board, and then any excess go to the queen's favor. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, also, it's got the increasingly common contemporary approach to worker placement, where either you put out a worker or you call your workers back. And when you call your workers back, they activate farms, and that's one of the ways to get resources. And interestingly, as a corollary to that, you don't have to ever call them back. You can just keep cycling them ad infinitum. Calling them back is a choice that you make based on various necessities.
Well, as long as someone keeps bumping them. There were several occasions where I had no choice, where I had no workers. They're all out, and they were not bumped, so I had no choice but to call them back.
Sure. Fair enough. Some of us played better than you did.
Oh, yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah.
As reflected by my score.
I thought it was mostly inoffensive, with a couple of promising elements. So overall, I'd say it's fair to middling. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Apiary.
Played a game of Air, Land, and Sea. This is a review copy we got from the designer, John Perry. John Perry, who is the king of small box games, as far as I'm concerned. And Air, Land, and Sea, unlike some two-player card games I played last week, has a very good element of knowing the deck, because there's only 18 cards. 12 of them are going to be playing in any given round. And the best part is you have to know when to stay in and when to get out. Because if you yield the round early, your opponent's not going to get many points. But if you fight to the bitter end, they're going to get a lot of points and you're going to be in trouble. It's one of those cases where I think, honestly, kind of like in Warfare, if it gets fought to the last play, somebody made a mistake. And that idea of pulling out early, which I very much appreciate from Games of Blue Moon, because Blue Moon is also the Reiner Knizia two-player card game, also operates on that principle. And Air, Land, and Sea just get things done in a remarkably tight and efficient way. There's the animal version of Air, Land, and Sea. There's also the standalone sequel, Spies, Lies, and Supplies. I want to get back to that. I still haven't played the combined version of Air, Land, and Sea, where you play 5 theaters across both boxes of game. I'm very curious to try that, because I suspect it's going to go one of two ways. That is either, this is amazing, or why did we take a simple game and make it twice as long as it should be? Now, I have my suspicions as to which of the two is true, but I have enough faith in John Perry that I really want to see it. I want to see how it looks. Anyway, I'm a huge fan of Air, Land, and Sea. I was very glad to get it back to the table, and I like both it and its sequel, Spies, Lies, and Supplies, very, very much. That is by John Perry, published by Arcane Wonders in 2018, Air, Land, and Sea, not to be confused with Heroes of Land, Sea, and Air. Is that the order?
I think it's pronounced bleh.
Thank you for that subtle right. Nuance to take.
So, on the subject of interesting card games, I got to try a game called Shorten Fruiten, or Shoot the Fruit, or Fruit and Shooter. All right.
So are you serious?
No.
Okay.
All right. So,
what's it actually called?
Shorten Fruiten.
Okay.
I believe that's how it's pronounced. I'm not sure. It's designed by CTR and put out by Studio Turbine. Hopefully, I'd like to get a real copy. So this was a proxy copy that I made because I can't get a copy. I tried my hardest, and when it does come out, I will probably get it. So this is a trick-taking game with a twist. All the normal things, you must follow suit, except the person who came in second wins the trick. And they take their card and any cards that were played that were offsuit, and they go into their scoring pile. And then if at any time you take a card into your scoring pile that matches cards you already have, that all cancels out. And you play all your cards, usually around 12, and then you score those points that you've happened to have. So it all usually breaks down to like the key rounds are near the end, because everyone has less cards that can follow suit. So you're like usually taking a whole bunch of cards into your scoring pile, and that's where it gets interesting. Now, the other crazy twist to this game is as soon as someone breaks 41 points, so goes over 40 points, that will trigger the end of the game and that person is out. they cannot win. Anyone else that has scored 41 points or more is also out. And the person that wins is the closest to 40 without going over. So the game breaks down into this crazy trying to feed people points, trying to cancel your own points, trying to get just a few. It is weird and bizarre.
Yeah.
And one person, and then Huey hated it with every inch of his life.
It sounds obnoxious.
I loved it.
Okay.
Other people enjoyed it because they just love trick taking games.
Sure.
I'm hoping to show this to you.
So is this okay? Can we play this? But I'm playing Gnar because I almost always end Gnar on a turn with 39 points.
That's what you want to do.
That's what. Yeah. Okay.
And that is Schottenfruden.
Wow. We get to play For Science. This was a two-player game of For Science designed by Eric Royce, who, full disclosure, is a personal friend of mine. The real-time co-op dexterity game. Super niche. But that niche is us.
Yes.
And we played with the expansion and those stars, man. Those stars. The star pieces. The genius about For Science. Yes, there's tiling. Yes, there's special powers. Yes, there's time pressure. Every time I play For Science, I am made to look at the recipe, the specific formula that I'm trying to build, the cure that I'm trying to build, and they're like, how do objects work? I have to manipulate these objects in a new way. And that is a marvel. Especially, like, whether you've been playing stacking games for 20 years like I have, every time I play For Science, I have to re-examine these objects, and that is a triumph and a joy. This particular time, what I had to do was take a piece roughly 5 to 8 times longer than the star, perch it on one of its little arms, and have the star be perched on an uneven surface such that the long beam was touching something else. I spent about 5 minutes working on that cure, and it could have been our downfall, or it could have been led to... I finally finished that sucker, and it let us pull the tile that let you finally find the cure. Honestly, I'm going to be remembering that for a while. I mean, honestly, was it the work of an insane person? Quite possibly. Maybe I should have just given up early. But
That's the awesomeness that is For Science. There's a time pressure because the clock is running. You have these crazy sort of cards that you have to interpret about, you know, what shapes are touching what. And like you said,
that are clear and deceptive at the same time.
Exactly. And like you said, you get to manipulate these pieces however you like. I'm getting to that. Except for the stars, which have to go upright exactly
just
the way.
Just call me the nemesis pictured. Because I just want to go stars.
Anyway, fantastic. And then besides that, when you complete a cure, it's going to tell you how many of these other tiles that you get, and you make this weird spatial puzzle where you have to lock off these snaking amoebas and trap these symbols, and that's your objective. You have to get maybe 13, depending on the players or difficulty you want. You have to trap so many symbols, and then you win. Fantastic game For Science.
And I'd just like to stress, as I've said before, one of the many great things about For Science is that, especially in a larger table, you can triage aggressively. Someone wants to deal with card management, they can do that. Someone else wants to just build and do nothing but build, they can do that. Somebody else just wants to play with the little tiles, leave them alone in the tile corner, they can do that. Someone wants to multitask, that's great. I don't think I've ever, the last game we played, I think I made a couple of suggestions about how to move a tile here and there. That's the most I've ever interacted with the tiles in a long time when playing For Science. And that's how I like to play it, because it's a tile laying spatial puzzle, which is is the exact activity that a number of people adore, and I don't want to touch. And so I felt in this case, because it was just a two-player game, it would have been unreasonable for me to be like, Walker, this is exclusively your problem. I felt that would have been not pro-social behavior, and so I decided to try to pull my own weight in that respect. For Science, it's so good.
So good.
We don't play it often enough. Given that it's only a 15-minute commitment with a couple of minutes of setup and teardown, and you constantly see something new, the only knock against For Science is that it is in a large box. It is a fat boy, P-H-A-T-B-O-I. And consequently, despite the fact that I'd be more than happy to have it punctuate almost any game event, it's not the kind of thing you can just toss into a bag. But it is what it is. For Science by R. Eric Royce, published by Grey Fox Games in 2021. Rumor has it, I don't have any inside information, this is not insider information, that there may be a reprint at some point.
That would be awesome.
It would be awesome.
On the subject of dexterity games, we played this new one. No one's heard of it before. Paku Paku.
Say that again?
Paku Paku. This is designed by Anton Boza and put out by Ravensburger. And once again, great times had by all.
On the topic of a dexterity game that can close off any gaming gathering.
Always drama on the Paku Paku. There was Paku Justice, and then there was Paku Injustice.
Yeah, there are lots of these claims. Paku Paku seems to have turned a number of people around our table into very strong moral theorists. Now, I say strong in the sense of the intensity, not necessarily of the quality of their analysis. But people seem to have very strong opinions about what justice looks like in the context of Paku Paku.
Agreed.
Just a marvelous consequence.
I believe all holds barred in all.
You're exaggerating.
To the wind is what
I
say clear. With Paku Paku.
I think we've made heard listeners about this before. I have seen Walker engage in behavior that I'm the first to say is borderline cheating. Now, mostly this is in co-ops that he engages in cheating. But this is a classic Rashomon situation where I heard people explain a situation.
Cheating is such a harsh word.
It's a harsh word, and it's appropriate.
Hand-holding in co-op games is like what I like to say.
Look, the kind of cheating that I'm talking about in co-op games is, so the communication restrictions say that I can't say, and then you state something. And then I'm like, Walker.
Never happened.
Yeah. Paku Paku, on the other hand, people have engaged in Paku Paku slander against you.
It's awful.
Because I've seen the things that they describe, and it seems like perfectly fine Paku to me. Anyway.
Exactly.
Anyway, Paku Paku, live the controversy, form your own opinions. Antoine Boza, delight. On the topic of perennial delights, we also played some missions of the crew Mission Deep Sea. Had some very, very tough mission draws. We were in a situation once where I had to draft a mission that I really couldn't satisfy because if I didn't draft it, Walker would end up with it. And then he would have ended up with two flatly contradictory missions. Like, I will win no yellows, and I will win the yellow six. It's like, well, we can't do both of those now, can we? So I guess I better take the one that says I'll win the yellow six, despite the fact that I don't have any yellows. All right, let's see how this goes. But it's great. Have we ever played any missions from the mission book in Mission Deep Sea Walker?
No.
I think every time it's been like, oh, let's pick a difficulty, put out some mission cards.
The deck's so magical.
It is magical. That is the word for it. It is magical.
It is.
Just the mere notion that we have all these other campaign missions that we could go to if we were ever inclined, makes me happy. We may never do that.
That's true.
And that is The Crew, Mission Deep Sea by Thomas Singh and Cosmos 2021. I will happily play The Crew, but Mission Deep Sea, I think, is much, much better.
All right, lastly for me, everyone knows. Does everyone know? Some people know. I love G.I. Joe, the deck-building game. And guess what, Mark? Another expansion, believe it or not. This one is called Raise the Flag Campaign Expansion. And this has everything that the name implies.
Does it have a flag?
Yes, it's the USS flag. It's that aircraft carrier.
Oh, so it's a play on words.
It is.
Okay.
It's the FLAGG. That stands for. Anyway, moving on. So the game comes with this giant.
That's the name of a perennial Stephen King villain, by the way.
Comes with a giant cardboard aircraft carrier that has slots where you slide in the special abilities for the aircraft carrier, place to hold cards.
It has little cardboard airplanes too. I've seen it. It's glorious.
It is glorious, and so we wipe out all of the other expansions, go back to core G.I. Joe.
Well, that's how you're supposed to play it, right? Okay.
Yeah, oh, for sure. So that's what we did. And it comes with secret envelopes. So you're adding secret cards in, which are all very interesting. It's almost like a marketing scheme because it brings back all of the old vehicles.
Almost.
Stopping there. No more spoilers.
Almost like a marketing scheme.
Almost.
It's a licensed tie-in of G.I. Joe. One of the most flimsiest exclusives to move product ever.
It's true. But I just mean, like, it seems as though it's like back in the 80s and they're trying to sell you more toys. But, you know, there's no toys to buy anymore is what I'm trying to get at. It is great. I liked everything about it.
Were you the one talking about a $2,600 plastic aircraft carrier?
Maybe.
Yeah, okay. Am I right? Was it $2,600?
I think it was $28.
Oh, I'm very sorry. Oh. I spend a lot of money on toys, but come on. $2,800.
Yep. Woo. It's great. It was this one thing came up. Normally you need like five or six successes.
Sure.
You roll these dice, you bring a bunch of Joes on the mission. This thing happened.
in the campaign, it says you need 14 successes.
Woo.
And we succeeded.
Well done.
And it was high fives all around. So when you have big moments like that in games, it's great. This is designed by T.C. Petty III, same person that did the base game, put out by Renegade Game Studios. I love G.I. Joe deck building. Another one, yet another expansion coming out soon. I know I say I'm probably going to skip this one. This one I will probably skip. It is solo for solo, and sure, it's for a trader mechanism, both of which I have no...
Yeah, you're not big on either of those, yeah.
Not big on either of those, so...
So during moments of glorious success, it's high fives. During moments of frustration, do you flip the aircraft carrier?
Yes.
Sending the little planes flying and... Yeah.
We launch it into the air and watch the little planes come down.
Okay. Lastly, we have returned to our campaign of My Island. This is the Reiner Knizia campaign game. We are on Chapter 6, and let me tell you something. Walker was waiting for a substantial change-up to happen, and without getting into specific spoilers, oh my, the moment I picked up the envelope and I felt how thick it was, I knew that we'd be in for something. It's basically like, all the previous scoring conditions, gone.
Yeah.
Have a whole bunch of new ones. Here's a new mechanism. Here's a couple other new mechanisms. There you go.
Yeah, it was like, they took my statements, you want something new? Well, hold my chits, watch this.
Yeah, it makes me think that they should have doled them out a little more judiciously. I don't object necessarily, but you were flagging a little, no pun intended, on some of the previous chapters. And this, I think, was a very radical sea change in terms of how the game operates. I think they could have been more judicious with the transition, personally.
Agreed.
But that having been said, I'm still enjoying My Island. It's wonderful. Reiner Knizia knows how to do tile laying. That's there. I said it. Two controversial opinions this week.
Madness. We're in so much trouble.
I know. And now we're going to take a brief break while we pay some bills.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
And we're back now for the news and why it doesn't matter.
Well, Mark, I want to thank the Everyday Board Games podcast. That's Daniel and Daniel. They turned me on to, because Huey and I really like a game called Nightfall. It is a sort of, vampire deck building.
Don't forget the werewolves. Vampires werewolves, and werewolves.
Chaining your cards together. So, and there's this new game that's coming out is some sort of Link. I didn't dive into it. I'm not doing this big expose on how they're related, but they're related somehow. The publisher is Trick or Treat Studios. They're going to come out with a game called Unchained, designed by David Gregg, and it's somehow based on Nightfall. So looking forward to that. Unchained.
So this is a bit of a correction from last week's announcement. I was actually a little bit confused as to when Omen from Smallbox Games was going to be on crowdfunding. It's on crowdfunding now. So it's there are three standalone sets that can be integrated with each other, and they're all available on crowdfunding right now, right now. So go out and get it. Omen is a very interesting dueling card game where every card has multi-use effects and the powers are gonzo bananas. And I'm very excited to see where the series is going.
So, Quacks of Quedlinburg, not my favorite game, but we play it a lot of two-player here with Butterfly Babe, and they're going to have a dedicated Quacks of Quedlinburg dual game, so two-player only. So that's something to look forward to. I might give it a try. Another bag-building game. People enjoy it. Push your luck.
One of my favorite two-player games this year was Votes for Women, published by Fourth Circle Games, about the ratification of the 19th Amendment in the United States, giving women the right to vote. Really, really well done, historically driven CDG design that nonetheless is very, very approachable, replete with lots of historical flavor and verisimilitude, coupled with a bunch of really fascinating component choices in terms of really selling home the theme. And the reprint is available on Kickstarter right now. So if you missed out on the first printing of Votes for Women, the second printing is on crowdfunding right now. Highly recommended. Votes for Women.
So, Mark, we love German games, we love interesting children's games, and we love magnets.
This is true. You've got my attention.
Here we go. It's called, here's another German game that I'm going to butcher. Sure. It's called Die Vertil Splunkencha. A cooperative game for 1 to 4 players. This is by Wolfgang Dirschel and Wolfgang Lehmann. And what happens, Mark, it looks like there's some sort of spatial movement. You're moving around this board, and then at some point, you get to turn a crank. And the crank is going to move these magnets underneath the board in some random way because they're hooked onto these ghosts that are on the top of the board. And if the ghosts bump into you, then the gates slowly close down on the outside, and you're trying to get out of this board before the gates close all the way down.
I'm there.
All right. It looks very adorable. And just the fact that you're going to have these ghosts sort of like shimmying around, I think the kids will love it. I think it's going to be a great little children's game. Die Vertil Spelunket. That's awful. I am sorry.
Check the episode notes.
Yes.
You'll see how it's spelled. Finally, for me, we neglected last time on a multiple of 5 episode to flog our Patreon, which we reluctantly do every 5 episodes. We have a Patreon. It is how we are able to maintain doing free media. And it has a whole bunch of bonus content. We release on average about a bonus episode a week. There are a whole bunch of rotating shows. Sizzler is going to be coming back soon, as will Pledge of Indifference.
And Mark does a great bloat episode every so often where he talks about all sorts of interesting things.
Well, I talk about things, that is for certain. Past that, some people seem to derive some value from it, and that I very much appreciate. Ad-free episodes, access to the Patreon, you name it. So if you're at all interested in supporting what we do, please do go visit patreon.com/swag.
Lastly, for me, we've got to play Nuculum once so far this year. Hopefully we'll play it more. An expansion already announced. Nuculum Australia. New map, new missions, new stuff. Nuculum.
So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now on to our topic for the week, which is adventure games. Walker?
Here we go. Let's start this off. What is an adventure game?
I don't want to define that in the answer. Okay, fine. If you want to define it in the answer, go ahead.
Because there's no real definition. There's the definition for me and the definition for you.
Okay, I'm going to regret this. I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to regret this, but you brought it up. In your head, is there a distinction between an adventure game and a dungeon crawl game?
No, well, it depends on the dungeon crawl game. If it's
sure.
If it's a campaign uh-huh. type dungeon crawl system, then uh-huh. it's not an adventure game in my head.
But if it's a one shot, it is?
Yes. I think that is the key part.
Huh.
Not the keyest part, but it is a key part. And it is something like that would campaign games sort of define for me what an adventure game is, right? Because campaign dungeon crawlers or adventure games go on and you have to keep track and you have to bring them back to the table.
Uh-huh.
Whereas adventure games is this one game. You get to do whatever you want because it's going to be over and there's no long-term ramifications. It's just a one and done fun experience.
Okay. I mean, I'm happy to go along with that as a working definition. In my head, when I use the terms, I don't necessarily think that a campaign element is a necessary or sufficient condition for it being or not being an adventure game. But to my mind, if it is a constrained location, if it's just like one place and you're going to be doing something, there's no traveling involved, there's no journeying, there's no map that you're going across. If it's a purely tactical enclosed environment where all you're doing is almost all you're doing is killing things, I tended to think of that more as its own separate kind of thing. But again, I'm not going to be dogmatic about it. I'm more than happy to discuss.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I've listed a bunch of games that I think, you know, are all on different areas of the spectrum, and we can talk about why we think they are or are not adventure games.
Well, I'd rather focus on the fact that hot take, most adventure games I don't like.
Oh.
Well, so
here... Well, let's just keep going on what we're going.
Okay.
I really feel as though there should be some sort of progression or
character development?
Yeah. Like a life advancement type thing. You know what I mean? Like this character used to be like this, and now it's like this. Like, I took them on this journey.
Sure.
They changed.
And then they came home realizing that they were not the same person anymore. And, yeah.
And there's a story sort of start to finish.
Yep.
Sort of like a prologue and, you know, and a climax and then an end.
Yeah, actually, that is another way to, I think, get at the distinction that I was trying to draw. The emphasis on narrative is often one of the things that differentiates, or not even narrative, but story. That differentiates an adventure game from a dungeon crawl game. Typically speaking, the story in a dungeon crawl game is there was this door, we kicked it open, and we murdered everything on the other side, and we rifled through their bodies. Whereas in an adventure game, typically, there might be dungeons involved, there might be doors to kick down and people to murder, but typically there's some attempt or gesture towards some broader story that's going on.
And so on that vein, sometimes I'm wondering if mechanics get in the way of that. I think with successful adventure games, they are usually very basic, right?
Sure.
You roll a few dice, wound, you know, defense, move on. It's very story driven. It's, you know, has other aspects than concentrating on the mechanics of the game.
Okay. Well, could you give me an example?
That's what I mean. I'm wondering if like Mage Knight, we're going to say Mage Knight is an adventure game.
I think it is.
But I wonder if you get bogged down in the rules, or a game like Clank where, the rules aren't, difficult or huge, but it makes you think of it more of as a game than as an adventure.
Hmm. Well, that's fair. And you're right. Trying to emphasize the fact that there's some... Mage Knight to me is an adventure game more based on the fact that there's the sense of voyage and going places, right? Which kind of contradicts my gesture toward... There's no narrative in Mage Knight. In point of fact, in the rulebook, in the explanation for the setting, they are great pains to emphasize, why are these semi-immortal badasses doing what they're doing? We don't know. They just showed up and started killing things. They're awfully frightening. And that's more or less the story.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing really compelling you except, you know, game mechanics say
sure.
that you must, you know, defeat X by the end. There's
right.
no sort of, you know, grand adventure. There's just, you know, get this done or you lose.
But there's a sense of scope, right?
True.
There's this idea that you're, you know, conquering castles, plural, and you're burning down this village or sacking this monastery, and then you go and you kill everything in a city, and you... I'm making it sound bloody because it is. And again, getting from point A to point B is part of the challenge of a game of Mage Knight. And when I think of most other, you know, more tactical skirmish adjacent things or things, I don't tend to think of treating movement or scope or scale in the same way. But that's one of the reasons why I think Mage Knight is a good example from the polar opposite. When I think of like two extreme opposite poles of really successful adventure games, I think of Mage Knight on one end, and on the other hand, I think of Legacy of Dragonhold, right? Legacy of Dragonhold has like practically no game mechanisms whatsoever. It doesn't even have a system for skills. It's just a bunch of keywords that say, oh, do you have this keyword? Read this paragraph. The paragraph based on herbalism or survival or runes or whatever it happens to be. And there, I associate with the story. I associate with the characters. Mage Knight, I don't associate with the story. I don't associate with the characters. I associate with the mechanisms. So I think they're both very, very successful at doing a similar kind of thing. but in very different ways.
Yeah, and that's sort of getting to the point that I was going to make, is that I feel good adventure games sort of bring you along on the journey, where Mage Knight just sort of says, here's the map, off you go, right? There's no sort of direction on where you need to go. You know you need to get out there, but whereas in other adventure games, it's like, oh, you need to find this clue, or you need, you know, you find this murder, or, you know, this first boss will lead you to the next boss. Yep. You know, it's all connected.
Well, I think that's one of the challenges of doing story well in board games. And I think this is one of the reasons why so many adventure games fail. Like, think back to the last one that we played that neither of us enjoyed at all. And that's the Witcher adventure game, right? It had all these encounters, but you couldn't get attached to any of the characters. And indeed, the writing didn't even really try to make any of the characters interesting, not even your own PCs, because there wasn't enough meat to hang on the bones. It was a series of stochastic, unrelated little things that had, like, very vaguely fantasy flavor. You heal this noble's daughter, and he gives you three monies, and
yeah, it's completely random off the deck.
Yeah, not only is it random, but there's no ability to chain them all together to make any sort of sense out of anything here.
Yeah.
And consequently, we didn't like the story. We didn't feel connected to it. We couldn't connect to the characters or the world, and the mechanisms weren't satisfying in and of themselves. So again, I appreciate an approach like Mage Knight that says, forget the story. We're here for the mechanisms. Or something, this is a false dichotomy, of course. Or Dragonhold that says, mechanisms, who needs them? I've got the story I want to tell, and I'm going to do enough to make you feel like you're controlling it, but this is absolutely about selling a setting and characters and a world.
I feel a lot of these were sort of derived from the granddaddy, right? We have Talisman.
Yep, exactly.
It started off, and it sort of like runs that line that I was talking about. It's like, go get a talisman.
Yep.
Then go beat the boss, right? So
yeah.
It sort of like led you along the way, right?
Yeah.
There was a mid goal and then the climax at the end.
Yeah.
Right?
I made kind of a gesture towards this when talking about Mage Knight. So many adventure games, Talisman does this, Mage Knight does this, The Witcher does this, Prophecy, Vlada Kvatl's first fantasy adventure game, which was basically a souped up talisman, does this as well. You have to make some sort of gut check where, am I ready to go kill the thing yet? And it is seldom straightforward, and that's one of the reasons why a lot of adventure games tend to drag. Because when you're a new player, not only are you playing suboptimally, and therefore it takes longer, you don't know when you're ready, and so it takes longer. By the time you know what you're doing, I don't know, half a dozen games into something, things might go really quick, but by then you've already played the game when it drags, and so how likely are you to come back to it? I mean, Talisman was infamous for lasting too long for other reasons as well, but part of it was just not knowing when you're ready to go do the thing. I also think, going back even further, what the hell? This is going to be the episode where I say a whole bunch of controversial things. Do you know who I blame?
Who do you blame, Mark?
I blame Tolkien. Because Tolkien established, it's kind of a victim of your own success, right? Tolkien established, in many ways, the Ur-fantasy formula, right? Which is about wandering along and weird things happening to you, right? Call it the Tom Bombadil model, right? So many fantasy adventure games in the modern board game hobby are married to the Tom Bombadil model. It's like, go to this node and pull a card, and the card says something happens. It's like, oh. And you try to put in character and flavor that way. But let me tell you, you don't have as much character and flavor as Tolkien did. Wasn't my favorite writer, but he knew what he was doing. So you end up with the same model of wandering around semi-aimlessly. Anyway.
Yeah, no, you can't just walk to the mound and throw it in the ring.
Yeah.
And the story ends.
Yeah.
It's all
yeah.
the cool stuff that happens on the journey there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know that board games are really good at doing that as a rule. Again, I think of the adventure games that I think are successful. Some of the other ones, the ones I mentioned, are things like Doomrock. And Doomrock is mostly just making fun of other fantasy tropes, right? And then it's focused on a very intricate combat system. And so it kind of seeks to bridge the gap between the more tactical skirmishy dungeon crawls and the more sprawling adventure games. There's an overland map, sure, but it's abstracted, and then you get into this very interesting combat system. The same is true, for what it's worth, of Too Many Bones, which I also think is reasonably successful. It has these weird little scattershot, unconnected little vignettes, but they're presented as, you know, vaguely humorous. The humor is kind of hit or miss, but most of your focus is not about traveling from place to place. You're on a fixed path to get progress points, and it's about these tactical combats. And so again, it's like, we are going to give you enough mechanisms to be satisfied by, and not instead focus on wandering around and weird things happening to you and deciding whether you're ready to take on the boss yet.
Well, I'm going to throw in Robinson Crusoe, Adventures on the Cursed Island, because they give you straight-up goals.
Mm.
You know, get this much wood, get this, and then all of the crazy stuff that happens to you on the way. It's like...
Yeah.
It's like, oh...
Adventure by way of Euro management. Yeah.
It's starting to rain. It's like, okay, well, we need to build a hut. It's like, oh, you got cold. Put this card in the deck. And it's like, why? What's that going to do?
Yeah.
And so I'm so much looking forward to playing more of that, because we have another one coming in. So.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting back to that. You're right, because adventure, again, the model that we have of adventure is there's some giant evil that's going to destroy the land, right? So many adventure games are fantasy or science fiction, and it's all about some great evil, and not about, like, it's raining and you're cold. This War of Mine tried to do the same thing. This War of Mine is also kind of in the adventure mold. I don't think it was very, very good at selling... the horrors of war. It mostly sold to me the tedium of scrounging for twigs. I think Robinson Crusoe was more successful at that. But you're right. I think that the ones that really don't fall into the standard adventure-y tropes to the same extent often have more success.
Now, we haven't really talked about it yet, but do you think either cooperative or all going towards the same goal, but, you know, coming in with a score at the end, or having a game master, do you think any of these are essential to a good adventure game?
Essential is a strong word. I mean, my default intuition in these kinds of structures games is co-op. And if you think about it, all the games that I listed, like my four favorite adventure games, they're all co-op, or the way that I prefer to play them in the case of Mage Knight is co-op. Partially, I think, just thematically. Like, this idea that there's a big evil in the world, or there's some evil in the world that a lot of them do, but you're all scrabbling amongst each other as to who's going to defeat it the best, that's so bizarre and petty. Yeah.
Well, I always talk about when we talk about these post-apocalyptic games or any of these other games, like, well, we could cooperate, but, you know, why would we do that? That would make things so much easier.
Yeah. Like, you're competing to see who's going to be remembered the best 100 years. I don't know. It's a justification. And honestly, like, so many games in the hobby sphere are premised on the flimsiest of thematic justifications as it is. I don't know why this one bothers me more than most, but it does. So, all things being equal, I do prefer co-op. And I don't like having to have someone be a game master. The whole 1v-all thing, it's really hard to do. And other than level 7 Omega Protocol, I'm more or less done with the sort of 1v-all dungeon crawly thing. But again, I don't think of that as an adventure in the same way.
Yeah, I have that further down my list. I was wondering if I could sell you on Space Hulk as an adventure game. But that falls into the trope as in the one dungeon. But
you're just calling it that because of the tagline on the box.
It does say... adventure role play, but I wasn't just putting it out there for no reason.
Yeah.
How about games that have like Space Hulk that have so much theme, and so much feeling of pressure and key moments and that sort of feel to it. I think, is that enough to promote it to an adventure type game?
Okay, at this point we're quibbling about, like, this is really splitting hairs about definitions. I will grant you that Space Hulk gets a lot closer than a lot of those other ones. To me, it doesn't necessarily do it because it's not so much a story as it is selling a vibe. It sells the vibe really well, right? But in very much the same way that Meltwater sells a vibe. Meltwater doesn't sell a narrative, it sells a vibe. And to my mind, that's enough of a difference. But again, I really don't care about these decisions at this point.
Yeah, I know. I'm wondering if Space Hulk, because we know the past and the lore of it, and so...
I don't really.
Well, enough of it to know what's going on. Whereas
I know that there are people...
Fresh in might
there are people
no
in armor, and they're really stupid, and they're basically fascistic power worshippers, and they go and do a dumb thing that's very dangerous. Have I got it?
You got it.
Okay.
All right, let's go on to the next one. How can I sell you on the quest for El Dorado? All right, so you are traversing.
Oh wow,
you are traversing across a map.
Okay, you're hoisting me on my own petard, right?
You can make the argument that as you're building your deck, you're sort of making your character better.
Ooh, no, right? You lost me on that one. Keep going.
And you're like going through traps and you're going through boats and you're on sort of adventure to get, you know, Indiana Jones style to get to get, you know, treasure and other things.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. the setting is very much in service of the mechanisms. And
it's true, it's one of these things much like Clank where...
It's a race.
Yeah.
It's like it doesn't even pretend as though the journey is part of anything other than just a race.
Yeah.
And so at that point, I'm not really... Like, similarly, Lewis and Clark. Lewis and Clark, if anything, is closer to me to an adventure game, and even that doesn't really constitute it, because there, yeah, it's a race, but it does a better job of selling the setting that you're racing through, right? But the Quest for El Dorado is more or less devoid of what I would call the sort of adventure-y personality. It's still a marvelous game, but I would actually put that closer. If you asked me to plot, Talisman or whatever other classic adventure game, or Formula Day, and asked me which one Quest for El Dorado is, I'd say it's closer to Formula Day.
Gotcha. All right, how about Die, 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 Die?
Sorry?
Cthulhu, Death May Die.
Ooh, nah, not really. I don't know really? Why, but...
It's a one-off. It's got a story.
Again, the one-off doesn't do it for me. It can be a campaign for me, and it can still be an adventure game. It does have a story, but again, the story is mostly about foolish people doing something very foolish. It's closer to Space Hulk than I thought it was. No, again, I mean, at this point, we're splitting hairs. Like, is Cthulhu Death May Die a game that is very good at selling a particular kind of vibe, that is very good at selling a very very particular kind of setting and being subversive about that setting while giving you a satisfying set of mechanical interactions? Yes. Does it necessarily fit in the adventure game bucket or not? At that point, I don't really care.
Yeah, I think Champions of... I'm going through... There's a list of adventure games, too, on Board Game Geek. So some of these...
Oh, but those categories are so broad.
They are.
Yeah.
But I pulled some, like, key ones. Like, I can almost make an argument for Champions of Midgard.
Oh, boy.
Right? You're sending your Vikings off to kill monsters, and you're collecting the dice, and it's sort of
Okay.
Kind of adventure-y. Let's move on. Android. Netrunner. Not Netrunner, just Android.
The original Android.
Original Android.
Yeah, I never played it. I don't know.
So you definitely have character advancement, and it's very dark.
That's true.
Right? And you're traversing all over the map.
It could
fall into that, you know, mechanical thing where it's just a bunch of mechanisms that bring you on that journey. But
yeah. I one could similarly make the argument for Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective. I mean, mysteries are kind of an adventure, and it's primarily narrative driven, and very much like Dragonholt, it lets it doesn't focus on the mechanisms at the exclusion of anything else. You might, by virtue of the criteria you've already elucidated, rule it out on the basis that there's no character advancement. But again, at that point, we might be splitting hairs.
Return to Dark Tower, I think, is very much an adventure game.
Oh. It's an interesting hybrid. Yeah.
The app brings...
It's awfully adventure-y, yeah. Yeah.
The app brings you on a journey. It definitely tells a story. There's midpoints where you're killing the sub-bosses and working your way up to the main boss.
No, you're right.
But not
in the sort of gut check way. You're it's a good mix. You're right. It's a good mixture of structure and freedom, such that it's kind of selling, and like the villain shows up and acts with a certain degree of personality at various points. Yeah, that's a good point. You're right. It's very good modification of some of the like standard pandemic tropes in a slightly more adventure-y way. That's well put.
And there's an old game called Rune Wars that I think is another, like you said, hybrid.
Old? Super ancient?
Of a hybrid adventure game. Because even though there's a troops on the map.
Yeah.
There is your leaders going out on these crazy adventures. While all this chaos is happening and these huge battles are being fought, your leaders are going into dungeons and they're getting items and they're coming back to lead some battles and they're doing all sorts of other things. And it does give you this larger scope of this whole world evolving as you're going along.
I did like the interaction of those two different levels. A lot of people found it very frustrating that you couldn't, you know, send your armies to go hunt someone else's hero. I thought it was fine. But I don't know that it really sells the setting the way you're talking about. For me, it was just the juxtaposition of the two scales that I found interesting. The actual adventuring portions felt an awful lot like the kind of adventure stuff that I've been criticizing, the stochastic random nonsense where you just pull a card and something happens and you pass a check or you don't.
True, but in the scope of the game, I think that's the right level.
That's fair. I mean, that I think is an example to add a little dash, a touch, a soupçon, a sprinkle, of the adventuriness to an otherwise elaborated troops on a map game. But I don't know that I would necessarily feel comfortable, therefore, calling it an adventure game as opposed to a game of adventure. Why are you making me split all these hairs, Walker? Why are you doing this to me?
I don't know.
I don't...
Because I find it interesting.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
And they only have one other one here because it's one that we both played, and that was Old Tree.
Old Tree.
Old Tree. Very beautiful looking game.
Yep.
had some parts where it seemed a little too light for its sort of theme. I wasn't sure who the game was made for.
Well, I think it was made for families. I think it was a family white game. My key opposition to Outre was that nothing. What I was doing wasn't very interesting, and there was a lot of skip a turn mechanisms, and there was a lot of just stockpiling stuff for events that might whack you upside the head. But yeah, it definitely was attempting to give a sort of a story structure to what was going on, and it did have a sort of adventure-y feel, despite the fact that it was fundamentally kind of a siege setup. Yeah, and definitely sold a world. I mean, the art was glorious, and it injected a lot of personality into those things. I just found the gameplay very, very dull. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, this is just reinforcing my generalized opinion. Like, it's really, really hard to do both mechanistically heavy and satisfyingly narrative. I mean, the one counterexample that I might offer, and this is only a very tentative one, is the old Magic Realm. Magic Realm, back from the 70s, it gave you a sense of narrative in the same way that a lot of roguelike games do. Namely, there's a huge universe of things that might happen and weird happenstances and circumstances that might occur such that the plays become memorable and injected with some degree of personality. And so just the sheer variety of the universe takes on a life of its own. But again, mostly when I play Magic Realm, it's for the mechanisms.
So you're looking for a heavier mechanism adventure game. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that I don't know if it's possible to make a game that could be as mechanically satisfying as something like Mage Knight and as narratively satisfying as something like Legacy of Dragonhold. I don't know if that's doable. Sorry, let me rephrase that. It seems very hard to do, and I haven't encountered one.
I have yet to see it.
Yeah, yeah.
While you're talking there, I was thinking about the micro macro and wondering if that's a type of adventure game. Because
you know what? I was thinking that too. Yeah.
It tells this elaborate story.
I think it does.
And brings you along. And
despite the fact that you're not a character in the story, there's enough of a story that the sheer discovery of the elements feels like you're being brought along on this great adventure. Yeah, no, I agree. I think micro macro, kind of like Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, is an example of how the mystery format can feel like an adventure if gamified properly. I agree entirely. Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our contact information as well as a wealth of other information at sowronggames.com.
Make sure you come and tell us, what your favorite adventure games are and how we got it so, so very wrong.
Yeah, because we haven't heard that joke before. We read everything you send us and we'll get back to you if we can. Thanks again for deciding to spend some time with us, and we hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoeseteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.